Welcome to Kingdom Conversations. I'm Curtis.
This is Ann.
I'm Sean.
This is Sally.
And I'm Christy.
Woo-hoo! Yay, we have a special guest with us tonight. Christy.
Yay. Thank you.
So we have Cinco on Cuatro de Mayo.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah.
Tomorrow's Cinco de Mayo.
Tacos. But there's no good... Well, there are good
Mizunte.
Tacos.
We'll
be at Mizunte.
What about the Perea household? We have good tacos.
You guys actually do have good tacos, but I have
to
say...
We actually have good tacos.
The salsa is pretty... It's the salsa over here at the Perea household.
I've heard rumors of the salsa. What's in it?
It's a secret recipe.
Oh.
If we said it, we would have to...
kill you.
Kill you.
Oh,
and
no.
Put the podcast.
And put you in the salsa.
Just kidding. We'll tell you off air. But yeah, we wanted... to take advantage of having Christy here visiting us, to have her join on and give us an additional perspective and share her story a little bit. So thanks for joining us.
Yes, this is exciting. Glad to be here.
Christy and I haven't seen each other in 10 years, but we knew each other in high school and we used to run together and we're going to run a race on Sunday. So we're super excited about that. But just catching up with Christy, she was sharing a lot with me about struggles she's had recently and in the past and over the years with addiction. And it's been a common theme, I guess, with some of my friends and just people I know struggle with addiction in different ways. So I think it can look, it's more common than we give credit to. And Curtis and I had talked when we had a conversation, just the two of us, a few weeks ago about this shame that people have when, like, it could be addiction, it could be an eating disorder, it could be, you know, cutting yourself or other things that you don't want anybody to know about because there's this, like, shame that comes over it, but that really, like, a lot of people struggle with these things and they come across in different ways. So I thought it might be a good topic to talk about if Christy was willing to share a little bit about her experience. And I know we all have different experiences. So,
Yeah, I think talking about something that is, you know, yours is, you know, it's better to talk about something that you've experienced as opposed to try to talk about something that you might not be an expert on. So you can be an expert on your own experience, your own perspective. And I certainly didn't think I would ever be someone who had an addiction, you know, as an athlete and, you know, always super hyper health conscious. And growing up, you know, it was like alcohol was bad and I never thought I would ever drink alcohol, but I live in California and I would say that there were so many things in my lifestyle that made it attractive. And, you know, I married a Frenchman and coming from a kind of who lived in the wine country, I think I was introduced, you know, to it in a very seductive way, that it was this classy lifestyle and sophisticated lifestyle. And I think I grew accustomed to having it as a daily or, you know, regular part of my life and feeling, you know, like, wow, this is such a great thing to have. I enjoy it. And it really becoming something normal and not recognizing that that is how it looks, I think, to a lot of people. And I think there's a lot of normalizing of an unhealthy use of alcohol or using, you know, using alcohol as an excuse or a party or something as an excuse to really, I don't know, be distracted from yourself or avoid what's really going on in the moment. Just like with our cell phones, even, I think we often find ourselves trying to look at something else, or do something else. And I think it comes in many, many forms. I'm, you know, would say that it's not very obvious. It kind of happens slowly, I think. It just becomes part of your daily routine or your regular routine. And I went many, many years thinking, gosh, you know, I don't have a problem. And I never thought anyone thought that I did. But it wasn't until, I would say, I went through a divorce and most of my social interaction with people involved alcohol. And I ended up renting an apartment that wasn't completely fully constructed. It was a brand new luxury apartment complex. And I did not know that I would be moving upstairs above a bar. And, you know, I was one of the first patrons when it opened. It was like one of the first things that people could go and do. And it was a pizza restaurant. I won't name the name of it. But it was a great establishment to go right after work. And it was just an elevator ride downstairs. And, you know, I remember meeting people and it seemed like, wow, you know, this is a great place to be because you weren't at home by yourself. And I think, you know, that song from Cheers would go through my head. Like now, you know, like you understand the jingle to the song. Yeah. Like people definitely would become regulars and you get used to it. And you get used to seeing people's faces. And so you don't, it's not necessarily about the drinking itself. I think it's more of, you know, why are you going and hanging out with strangers all the time? What kind of community have you established for yourself? And I think people going through divorce often find themselves disconnected because you're no longer with your family that you once had. And you've, you know, as an adult, you're not living at home with your parents anymore. So you have to kind of find that new community. And I think it's one of those places that people maybe going through a divorce can easily find themselves attaching themselves to. And it's not that easily recognizable that it's a problem, because why would you think it's a problem when everyone's doing it?
Right.
So I would say that would be one of the first memories I have. And, you know, kind of the people you're attracting in your life with, you know, you don't have much in common, but the fact that you met at a bar. So what can I say about that? Should I keep talking?
You're doing awesome.
Okay. Well, I would say like my major experience was that I met somebody, you know, while I was going through divorce and when I probably should have been in therapy. I think I, you know, try to convince myself that I was ready to move on in a relationship and met someone who I met at that particular bar, and all red flags pointing that, you know, this is probably not a good decision. I ignored all of them. I think I intentionally ignored them because I thought, well, if I did everything right before and it didn't work out, maybe I should ignore my own red flags and just try something different. And so I allowed this person to move in with me with no expectations on their part to contribute and to pay their way or, you know, have any responsibility. And I think that's one of the things that led to me more focusing on, okay, what's wrong with this picture? And clearly, you know, alcohol was a regular aspect of it. And, you know, ultimately I said to that person, I said, you know, I'm leaving for work. And when I come home, I want to know who you're going to be getting therapy with and treatment from. And so we ended up going in for couples counseling on drinking. We went in saying we want to both stop drinking as much. That was the goal. We just want to cut back. And really the underlying aspect of this was that I learned what codependency is. And I, you know, and it took me many years to learn that codependency has two sides of the coin. One of that is the codependent part, and the other part's the addiction. And so, not understanding what that relationship addiction was kind of at the heart of it, you know, and not allowing that time to just be by yourself and getting to know yourself, you know. So, while alcohol might be a vehicle for addiction, there's so many more forms of it in relationships and technology, cell phone use, and really just many ways to avoid yourself. And that's one of the things I've learned is that I think focusing on a new relationship as opposed to focusing on the fact that I was going through a divorce was an example.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So I think I have had to kind of learn that lesson over and over again before you realize you're making that it becomes so obvious that, you know, you're really not paying much attention to yourself. And so ultimately, that relationship didn't work out, and it was for the better. And I started on this journey of healing and reading books about codependency. And it was still not something I fully understood. And I still look back on, you know, some experiences even in my childhood, like the examples that I grew up around. You know, I had a mom who was extremely welcoming to helping anyone and everyone. And, you know, she was a nurse. I'm a nurse. And that's something that you find in the healthcare professions is people often putting others before themselves. Mm-hmm. And I remembered about a time my mom took an entire family in who didn't have anywhere to live when she was a single mother with children who was renting a small apartment. And it actually wasn't something that was allowed by the complex. And I just only recently remembered this, and I told the daughter of the family that she brought in. I said, "Hey, do you want to go roller skating in the laundromat?" Which we weren't supposed to do, and so we went over and we're roller skating, and the manager of the apartment complex comes in and says, "What do you think you're doing?" I said, "We can do anything we want." Oh. And, nice. And I said, "And by the way, there's 10 people living in our apartment." And so, so what does that have to do with addiction? I guess where I'm going with is that, you know, at an early age, you kind of learn that if you see somebody else breaking the rules or putting themselves after other people, you don't realize how much that becomes part of your own psychology, you know, putting yourself in a risky situation to help other people. And I think that's what I've had to learn is, it's not just about the chemical, because, you know, as a nurse, I don't need someone to tell me this is bad for your health, this is bad for you, you know, you on a physical level. I had to learn you need to put all that energy into taking care of yourself,
right?
You know, and that's been the hardest thing is putting myself first and not feeling guilty, you know, letting someone else have to deal with their own consequences. Mm. So
right.
And one of the things that my therapist said to me, he's like, you know, you married someone with children, you helped raise their children, you were a nurse taking care of other people. And he said, when do you think you were taking care of yourself? And I said, I wasn't. He's like, no, it was when you were drinking.
Oh, whoa.
That was what I was doing to take medicine. Care of myself.
Yeah, that's crazy.
You know, that as a nurse, medicine.
Yeah. That's and crazy. So I had, you know, and I had to learn, like, you know, look back on all these situations where, you know, I was always trying to anchor myself in some way.
Yeah.
And not even knowing that, you know, it was really ultimately keeping me from listening to myself. And, you know, I think it was intentional sometimes because you didn't want to deal with the fact that, gosh, you know, I really wish I hadn't put myself in this situation, you know. And so sometimes you just think, well, it's okay. I'll just drink some wine and I'll think about it. Or sometimes I would drink wine and go, that'll make me really think about what I'm feeling. But it really, you know, it really clouds your judgment. And, you know, it kind of takes away from looking at things with a clearer and sound perspective. And so I'm finally in a situation where I feel like I guess my experience is allowing me to see other people might be struggling with the same thing. So, you know, it's one of those things that I think a lot of people struggle with on their own because they are ashamed to talk about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that people should feel that there isn't a community out there of support. I've recently been reading some things from Brené Brown, who talks a lot about shame.
Sean loves her.
Yeah. She's good.
So
Dr. Brené's got some good stuff.
So
was that a big thing that you dealt with, was shame? Did you find that was something that you lugged around with you?
I think so. I think there were so many, definitely, I think, you know, if you peel back a lot of the layers, I could have like lots of things like being adopted and, you know, being like ashamed to tell people you're adopted, or being confronted by strangers, oh, you're sisters, you don't even look anything alike. And, mm-hmm. you know, you're kind of like, yeah, I wonder what it'd be like to look like my relatives. Mm-hmm. So when I finally found out who my parents were and found out all the things they went through, that brought a lot of shame. You know, I was thinking, you know, wow, they really went through a lot of really difficult situations that sometimes, you know, you want to share with other people, but then you're thinking, gosh, you know, are they going to understand? So there's the shame that comes with that, wanting to be able to honestly share your story without shame.
When you were starting off with, you know, alcoholism is very much part of my history as well. Just wondering if, you know, had you tried to quit a bunch of times? Was there a time that you tried to assert yourself against the authority or the addiction itself and found yourself failing? Or
when I initially got into it, it was never presented to me as having an alcoholic or alcoholism. It was presented as codependency. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And that I had relationship addiction, and that mm-hmm. I and drinking was more of a side effect of that. And so I didn't, because of that, I had to focus more on self-care, learning, you know, what are 50 things you can do besides drink?
Right.
And so I'd actually be given these assignments, write down 50 things you can do besides drinking. And I was like, well, I could clean out my shoe closet. Mm. I could donate some clothes. I actually had to put effort into it. I was like, 50 things. And what I realized was that it had become such a center focus of my life that I wasn't really doing a whole lot of things that I used to do, like running.
It had replaced a bunch of things.
It had replaced a lot of things. And it seemed like the hours in the day were much smaller. And so that's one thing I noticed. Your life is really small when you have this thing that takes so much of your energy when you don't really think it does. For other people, maybe it's not that way for them. But for me, it took a lot of energy. And when I wanted to do other things, I found that, well, this was quite a hindrance. It's certainly not in alignment with my health goals.
Go figure.
You know, it's a little bit harder to get up and go running with a hangover.
I remember those days in the Marine Corps.
Yeah.
Hard to get up and run with those hangovers,
yeah.
Or still drunk.
Yeah, and I did actually, but it's kind of like you're like, what are you willing to give up? Are you willing to give up something that is a big part of your childhood that brought you good memories that you're not mm-hmm. going to do anymore, or are you going to give up this thing that's keeping you from having that connection to your past, the people that knew you? And so anyway, going back to your question, did I ever try? Yeah, so that was when I got into, I thought it was treatment for codependency. And that allowed me to start taking some medication called naltrexone. And the day I took it, it was like I never had a problem ever again. You know, it was like,
wow.
It was more like I was fine. And I went several months, like 6 months. And I ended up just kind of developing this slowly moving momentum that just became this really powerful changing force in my life. And it has like a ripple effect on your life. I ended up buying a home in Silicon Valley, and I got a new job that I still have, and really just kind of pulled myself out of this place where I was more just, what do you want to call it, treading water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just not going anywhere, mm-hmm. and just
energy of staying in the same spot,
kind of the same spot. But I, you know, and I thought, well, I could never buy my own place in Silicon Valley, so I never tried. But then I started to say, why don't I challenge that belief? And I'm going to actually, instead of believing something that I just think without actually checking it out, yeah. I started making phone calls. And good thing, because one, other people who had told me I couldn't do it were wrong, and me telling me I couldn't do it was wrong. So I actually did it. And I did end up running out of the prescription, and slowly over time, when I forgot that I had that problem in the first place, I did find myself back into the old patterns. But I knew that time around, I knew it was like, you shouldn't be doing this because you already know where this could go. And but I kept thinking, well, no, because you never really had a, you know, you kind of rationalize it. Well, it's temporary. I'm just having a good time.
I just need it now.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. of course, the place I bought is next door to a liquor store. So that doesn't help.
Well, convenient.
Yeah. And it's really something that I think we should survey, like how many, you know, one of the things my therapist said, you know, like I lived in this luxury apartment complex that would offer these great get-togethers, like champagne brunch, yeah. unlimited mimosas and things. And he's like, you know, they want you to have a problem.
Right.
And you know, Silicon Valley has recently done some new segments on it's more than just a problem, and it's targeting a lot more women too. So I think most people used to think it was mostly a male dominated
issue. Right. Because they'd go out to the bars after work. Yeah. Yep.
And I've met a lot of people who have tried to get help. And one thing I've learned is that people have to want it. I think you have to want to do it yourself. And, in the relationship I was in when I started, the thing I was taught is you have to let people hit rock bottom. I had someone living with me who kept saying they wanted to get help, but when it came right down to it, they walked away. They didn't really want the help. And that I struggled with. I thought, oh my God, if this person dies on the street, it's going to be my fault. Mm. Yeah. And that was something I had to learn. No, it's not my fault. But that was the codependent in me trying to save someone else and not myself, and recognizing my own problem.
Well, when you started taking the medication, the naltrexone, mm-hmm. is that right? It really seemed to help with the alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
But what was the long term? Where are you at with the codependency, which is really mm-hmm. what you talk was kind yeah. of the engine of
yeah.
the train?
I think it's something I think it's something that I'm only now starting to be able to recognize. Like I recently went on a vacation and I was told my therapist about it. I said, oh, it sounds like you had a codependent relapse, because there was a 24-year-old girl there who went on vacation with a 53-year-old and didn't really know him, and found herself in a foreign country with someone that she felt uncomfortable with. And of course, I found myself in a situation extending myself, you know, and kind of regretting it.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to go back on my word, but those are the situations where I oftentimes find myself volunteering myself to help people. And I don't really know her. I don't know what risks that could have come with. And so I think that learning to have boundaries is something I'm still working on, you know.
It sounds like something in your when you talk about your mom,
mm-hmm.
I mean, some things that can kind of modeled in how your mom kind of would take yeah. people in and stuff. And do you see a connection there?
Oh, absolutely. And I think I used to think it was a measure of my moral character.
Right. That's what I was just
And so it's hard
about.
When mm-hmm. it's part of this moral code that was ingrained yeah. in you. And, you know, I have to say, my mother died at the age of 59. And she did die of liver cirrhosis, but she never drank alcohol. It's ironic, actually.
Wow.
She never drank. And I think that her unfortunate situation was a result of completely not ever focusing on herself and her health and her own physical needs, and constantly giving to other people. Mm. And you think, gosh, that's such a great thing to do. But it's actually, you know, that person who's doing so much for other people, if they're not taking care of themselves, all of that fails. And and all those people who became dependent on that person to enable them
mm-hmm.
also fail. So it's actually a very it's very catastrophic, you know, to constantly
yeah.
enable other people. And I think I certainly had no clue that I you know, was an enabler, you know, and I've been an enabler in my profession, my professional life as well, in certain circumstances where, you know, I being an exempt employee, I work 80 to 100 hours, never having a weekend off or holiday, because I somehow felt it was my duty to make sure the company doesn't fail. Right. And, you know, yeah, the CEO is on, you know, a yacht somewhere.
Yeah.
Certainly not feeling like you're feeling.
It wasn't my company. So I've had to, like, you know, that was actually, I think, one of the stronger things that I think I had to overcome was learning to walk away from that job where I felt I had built the company and, you know, and things like that. So it's been a gradual transition. And now I'm just like, my goal is to continue to build those boundaries. They say the happiest people are those with the strongest boundaries. So
I've never dealt with codependency. I've had people tell me I'm codependent before, but I really feel like I'm definitely not codependent. But while you were talking about it, I was thinking a couple of things. I've personally never had any kind of addiction to alcohol, although I've had addiction to other things. But I used to bartend, and I bartended right when I first turned 21, right when I was first able to work in a bar. Mm-hmm. I didn't go to like a club or a sports bar or anything. I was working a little hole in the wall that had a separate entrance from the restaurant, and it was almost entirely an after work crew. And we had we didn't even keep the bar open till 2 a.m. I think the bar closed at about 9 or 10 o'clock at night, just because it was completely from 4 until 7 p.m. where I had the same people in and out every weekday. There was nobody there on the weekends. The weekends were dead, but I had the best after work crew, and they became my family. They literally became my family. And what was crazy was when I was going through a divorce and I was working at this bar going through the divorce, and I really, really relied on those people, was when I realized that I have nothing to do with these people. I have no life experiences or interests or anything apart from the couple of hours that we spent every day in the bar. And when I needed somebody, those were the people that I had relied on for 2 or 3 years for all of my social and emotional needs. And unless we were in the bar drinking, they were just nowhere to be found. These are not real friendships per se, even though I don't want to say that these friendships were not, I mean, they were real in their setting. These people were dear to me, dear to my heart. And they were all, you know, I was 20, 23, 24 years old, and they were all gentlemen in their late 40s and 50, up to about, you know, between like 40 to 60 years old. One woman, and they were good to me. They bought me a puppy. You know, they tipped me well. They knew my life. They knew my problems. But although I was never addicted to alcohol, I was absolutely addicted to that social engagement. And when I got a divorce and left our hometown, I was lost without that situation. And I couldn't reestablish it because, you know, going from a small town where we grew up to a college town, I was unable to duplicate that experience and duplicate that kind of a friendship. And I did become very lost without it, and without having had any solid, real friendships built upon that time in my life. And that's when I entered addiction. I entered bulimia, which is a different kind of addiction. But so I just wanted to kind of say that, like, I don't understand being addicted to alcohol, but I completely understand that bar scene when it's not like a club, but it's like an actual, like, where you go and it's everybody knows your name. Exactly. It's it creates a, for me, I don't want to talk for other people, but for myself, it definitely created a false sense of like family and communal support that was real inside those walls and at that bar. It was real, but it was only there, and it wasn't a lasting thing, and it did keep me from creating truer, healthier friendships.
I think that's where I go with what codependency is teaching me to recognize one-way relationships.
One-way, that's perfect. I've never heard that before. That's perfect.
It's a one-way relationship, mm-hmm. and alcohol is a one-way relationship.
Yeah.
You know, alcohol isn't there for me.
Right.
It's not right. going to pick the chips up for me.
Right.
And that's some of the exercises that I've had to go through. And I remember saying, "Oh, I'm ready for the next relationship." He's like, "Really? So what is it that person's going to have?" You know, and looking back on it, we can talk about it now with my therapist. Like, he's like, "I knew you weren't ready for a relationship, but I knew you had to have that exercise."
Yeah.
You know, and he said, "I want you to write a list of who you are, but it can't be something you can measure." You know, and so much mm-hmm. of us, we're always measuring ourselves, like how much money do we make? And
yeah.
other people are looking, you know, are people with you because of your, you know, your status, your, you know, are you making friends that really know you and value you, or do they value what you have?
Right.
Do you value other people for what they right. have or what they can offer you? And I think that's pretty much ingrained in our society a lot, and it's celebrated. But I think it leaves a lot of people feeling like no one really sees me for who I really am. And
yeah.
I think that's kind of at the core for many people anyway that I've gotten to know. And I have had to close the door on several relationships just because I recognized that they offered and served no benefit to my life. And I actually thought that some of the friendships I had were meaningful because I was lending people money.
Right.
I was somehow valuable to them. And
right.
I was somehow supposed to be getting something out of that. And it's not that I don't want to lend people money if they truly need it.
Right.
But I think that what I was recognizing is that it was, the codependency was rampant in many aspects of the relationships I had. And I eventually just had to make a decision to walk away because those were actually draining me and keeping me from, you know, you only have so much space seats in your life,
right.
at least for me. I only have so much energy I can give to the relationships in my life. And if I'm giving that seat up to someone, it takes away from somebody else who actually might be able to cultivate a two-way relationship and friendship. So that's the hard truth, I think, in part of recovery is being able to learn how to walk away and let go. And, you know, if that means having one friend that's, you know, a healthy relationship, I think that's success. But I think for me, it's really about that relationship with myself and becoming truly my own best friend and ally.
Yeah.
You know, and I think when I've learned, at least for myself, I realize when you're really there for yourself, you really don't need a lot of other people
right.
because you're there for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Any other valuable people, like you talked about when you referred to codependency and alcohol, you talked about the one-way relationship. How about some additional sources that outside of therapy, did you have some healthy two-way relationships that were have some bearing on your
during that
recovery
time?
Or either then and now? Or
I would say that I've been fortunate to have had some really great friends who have never judged me, no matter how, and really given me a lot of their time. You know, I can tell you when I first started going through my divorce, I think for months I must have been on the phone for hours and hours a day with one of my friends. And in fact, to a point where probably she didn't do any housework because she was giving me her time. So I think, you know, I'm very grateful to have had friends who would just listen and listen and listen, because that must have been exhausting. So
good
I would
friends.
Say, yeah, I think that's one of the things I've learned. Like, you know, I know that I would do that for a friend. And I think that I think that's one thing you learn quickly with at least what I did is I learned who my friends were, you know, during those periods. And it's hard. I think some people, they want to come out and tell people, oh, I have an addiction problem. And sometimes you get people who say, wow, I'm so proud of you. And then sometimes you get people who are, that's an opportunity that they've been waiting for to try to bring you even further down. I think, so I think doing that work and recognizing that it's really about being true to yourself and being your own best friend, you have to be prepared to recognize that those are toxic relationships. And sometimes they might be your own family. So that's where the boundary lessons need to come in. You can't really choose your family, but you can choose how much time you spend around certain people and
boundaries.
Learning what amount of time are you willing to give? Are you able to give before it impacts you in a negative way?
Gotcha.
I hope that answers your question.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you talked about loving, you know, giving, you know, caring for yourself and loving yourself, remind me of scripture passage. It talks about, you know, loving your neighbors, you love yourself.
Right.
And oftentimes the focus there always goes to the loving your neighbor part, and it gets de-emphasized the fact of being able to love yourself. If you don't love yourself in a good way, you won't be able to love anyone, or otherwise they'll say, you know, I've seen your love, keep it far from me, kind of thing. But so there is a value, a great value I see too in an agreement and talking about scripture of, you know, you need to have a healthy love for yourself so you can be a healthy person. Otherwise, what good can you offer anyway?
Well, that's going to do it for this episode of Kingdom Conversations. Be sure to check out our website at kingdom-conversations.com. You can find all of our blogs and all of our previous podcasts there. You can also find us on iTunes. And on our website, you can also find a link to our Facebook page. And we'd love to have you visit us on Facebook and reach out to us and let us know what you think and if you have any questions or topics you'd like us to talk about. Be sure to come back next week when we finish our conversation about addiction with our guest, Christy.